And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Ussery, and I'm honored to welcome David Marinus to the program today. David is a two-time winner of the Pulitzer Prize for his work at the Washington Post. He has authored or co-authored a dozen books of nonfiction, many of which have been bestsellers and award winners. His subjects have included Barack Obama, Vince Lombardi, and the 1960 Rome Olympics. Today, we'll be discussing his latest, A Good American Family, The Red Scare and My Father, which is published by Simon & Schuster. David, what's the significance of room 740 of the Federal Building in Detroit for your story?
That room was where my father was called before the House Un-American Activities Committee when they came to Detroit to investigate communism in the Detroit region. It's where the committee set up and where dozens of witnesses were called over a two-week period, including my father.
How many of these types of hearings took place around the country outside of Washington, D.C.?
You know, there are far more regional hearings than people might think. The committee went to Hollywood several times. They went to Cleveland, Detroit, Chicago, New York. They chose specific targets. And the point was not to sort of set themselves on these communists or former communists, but simply to get publicity. So they went to Hollywood because they knew that would be a place where they'd get a lot of publicity going after screenwriters. In Detroit, their effort was essentially, their motive was to go after the local of the United Auto Workers, Local 600, which was the largest local in the country and had a communist and socialist influence in it. What happened was that for these hearings in room 740 in 1952, there was a special witness testifying for HUAC who had been a secret agent for the FBI for 9 years, a woman who became known as the grandmother spy, who was paid by the FBI to join the Michigan Communist Party. She rose through the ranks for 9 years and came in from the cold at those hearings and named hundreds of names, including my father's.
And so how did your father get to know Toby, as she was known?
Toby Baldwin, well, she befriended anybody who was involved in the Communist Party during that period. My father at times wrote and edited for a newspaper, first called the Michigan Herald, and then it was a version of the Michigan Worker. He was known as Ace, which was his college nickname, but Toby Baldwin was often at the offices of that newspaper, which had some communist connections, was supportive of the Progressive Party in 1948 of Henry Wallace, but she came to know him there.
It seems her motives were purely financial. She didn't seem, the way you portrayed her, to have any particular dog in any hunt there.
You know, so many informants were former communists who were disillusioned or were under pressure to testify and name names. She wasn't like that. She was recruited by the FBI. Her husband then, who wasn't her husband for very much longer after that, actually encouraged her to do this. It's a mystery to me why he did that, because he died shortly thereafter, and there was no record of him that I could find any. So what his motivations were, I'm not sure. She was a working-class woman who needed the money, and over the course of time had this contradictory sensibility of at once sort of feeling that she was doing a patriotic duty and befriending the people that she was going to eventually name.
Did later in her life she ever express any regret for what she had done?
Not that I know of. This was 1952 and she was 49, so she was long gone by the time I started this book, as were her children. But I found her grandchildren, and that was a fascinating interview because the granddaughter said, you know, I'm always straightforward with anybody I'm dealing with. So I first talked to her, I said, my father was called before the committee in Detroit in 1952. Your grandmother named his name. I just wanted her to know, you know, no hard feelings, but that's the way it was. And she said, you know, I didn't know about that at all. And I was very close to my grandmother, but only when my mother died, we went into one of her closets and found all these old clippings about my grandmother. And that's the first time I ever heard about it. She never talked about it. And then she said, did your father talk about his situation? I said, no. You know, it was sort of similarity in that sense from different perspectives.
So you were just a toddler when this happened, right?
I was not yet three.
How did you finally come to know this and decide that this is something that you had to write about?
Well, it was a shadow in our family's lives for a long time. My father didn't talk about it. My mother didn't talk about it. He would talk about his distaste for Joe McCarthy, who became sort of the symbol of anti-communism in that era, and for Richard Nixon, who was at one point on the House Un-American Activities Committee. But he didn't really talk about his own story. We knew that he had been blacklisted and that he'd recovered and moved on and had a very successful life. So while he was alive, my siblings and I were doing many other things and not really focused on that part of our family history. But I'm a biographer. I've spent a lot of my life studying the lives of people who were strangers to me when I started, whether it was Barack Obama and Bill Clinton or Vince Lombardi and Roberto Clemente. And after 4 years of deep research, they became familiar to me. And I came to understand in that process, like interviewing Barack Obama about his family, there were a lot of myths that he innocently would pass along, like saying that his Indonesian step-grandfather died heroically fighting the Dutch in the War of Independence in Indonesia. And I went back and found the records, and the grandfather died falling off an ottoman in his living room trying to change the drapes. So, I mean, I'm just using that as an example of mythology that every family has somewhere in their past. And I wanted to find out about mine. I was in my 60s. My parents were gone. This was not a book I was going to write while they were alive because they didn't feel comfortable talking about it. But I had this need at that age of my life to understand my own family's past.
Were there any large bits of family lore that you found out weren't true during the course of this investigation?
Not large bits. I mean, little things like, you know, I'm not sure that my father got a baseball scholarship to Michigan, which he often said he did. I know that he tried out for the team at Michigan, but that, you know, that's neither here nor there. But on the major things, it wasn't that there were things that had been said that weren't true, but things that just weren't said at all that I found to be true. And there were times when I had to shake my head and say, Dad, what were you thinking? I mean, you know, he wasn't around, but that's what I was saying. Like at the University of Michigan in 1939, he was a brilliant editorialist, but his essays were sometimes rationalizations for Soviet behavior, like the Nazi-Soviet pact in 1939 before the start of World War II. How do you defend that? It's indefensible. But he did, and that was the way he was thinking at that point. It's not the way he was thinking by the time I knew him at all. He was a much different human being who taught me to search for the truth wherever I found it and not fall for any rigid ideology. But there was a point in his early life when that's the way he was thinking and writing, and that I didn't know that.
But also, if you think that it's just at 1939, 10 years after the Great Depression starts, and that
yes.
So many people had antipathy toward capitalists and the big banks because they made so many tens of millions of Americans miserable.
I completely understand his motivations, and I consider them idealistic. And in the largest sense, right. You know, capitalism was failing during the Great Depression, and it was on the rocks. You know, millions of people suffered from that. So you understand the desire for more economic equality. At the same time, Nazism was on the rise in Germany and fascism in Italy. So you understand how that would bring somebody to a different point of politics. And then you had the fact that was true then and is unfortunately still true in some ways and always has been in America about racial injustice. So when you combine those three things, economic equality, search for racial justice, and a fear of what was going on in Europe with the rise of autocrats, you can understand why somebody could be lured into that perspective or be drawn to it. I should say more than lured. He wasn't lured.
In America in particular, do you think the strong aversion toward communism was tied up in that sense of they supported racial equality for African Americans at that time, and so many of people on HUAC over the years were members from the South who had a vested interest in keeping the social order that way?
It's an enormous contradiction, and it's really at the heart. The central theme of my book is what does it mean to be American? And so you had my father, who not only was always supportive of racial justice, but walked the walk in World War II. He was the commander of an all-black unit that went to Okinawa. And you can see from the hundreds of letters that he wrote my mother that both his understanding of the complexity of that situation, where you're asking young African-American men to fight and die for ostensibly liberty and democracy for a country that treated them as second-class citizens. When my father understood that and was proud of the way he was able to develop esprit de corps in that unit that he commanded and make those young men feel that they were getting a fair shake, at least from him. And then to be called un-American by a chairman of the committee from Georgia who'd voted against every civil rights bill for decades, had voted for the poll tax to keep blacks from voting, had been briefly a member of the Ku Klux Klan, among other secrets of his past. The contradiction is enormous, and you see that throughout the history of the House Un-American Activities Committee, dominated by Southern racists calling other people un-American.
If there is someone that comes closest to be a villain besides Hideki Tojo and Hitler and Mussolini in this book, that would be the Georgia Congressman John Stevens Wood. And he had a very long history of doing ill to his fellow citizens.
Well, the part that I didn't know about before I assumed that a Georgia congressman in that era would be a segregationist. They all were from the South. But what I didn't know and only discovered in researching this book was his involvement in perhaps the most famous lynching in the South in the early 20th century, the lynching of Leo Frank, who was a Jewish industrialist who ran a pencil factory in Atlanta and was charged with murdering a 13-year-old woman who worked in his pencil factory. He was framed. He was treated as a carpetbagger, an outsider who came down from New York and was changing the pastoral ideal of the South. And so there was a lot of antipathy toward him as a Jewish man from the North. Anyway, he didn't commit the crime. And it was sort of like the O.J. trial of its era. Not a perfect analogy, but it was the biggest story in the South. And so the New York Times and the Chicago Tribune and many northern papers covered it every day. It actually was the reason that the Anti-Defamation League was founded, because of that Leo Frank lynching. There was so much evidence that he was innocent that the governor of Georgia commuted his death sentence. Not his conviction, but his death sentence. And that so enraged the powers that be in Marietta, Georgia, where this girl was from, that they concocted a plot to go up to the prison where Leo Frank was being held, get him out of that prison, drive him down to a field near Marietta, and lynch him. The mastermind of that plot was a judge, the most powerful person in Marietta, named Newt Morris. And Newt Morris's chief disciple was none other than John Stevens Wood, the future chairman of the House Un-American Activities Committee, who drove the car that carried the lynched body of Leo Frank to the mortuary.
In this case, you see justice not being served in the courts. Later on, we see essentially a kangaroo court in some of the goings-on later on, when especially George Crockett, when he was in a case with Judge Medina serving. The contempt of court charge at the end of the trial was just breathtakingly horrible.
George Crockett was a black lawyer from Detroit who was part of the first integrated law firm in America, and he was selected to be a defense lawyer at the seminal civil liberties trial of that era, which was called the Foley Square Trial, where the top 11 members of the Communist Party USA were indicted and tried and eventually convicted and sentenced to prison for being communists. That meant prima facie that they were for the violent overthrow of the American government. There was no evidence produced at the trial that showed that any of them had been plotting the violent overthrow of the government. It was just assumed that because they were leading communists, that was their mission. George Crockett was not a communist. He was a deep believer in civil liberties and saw the connection between the denial of civil liberties to African Americans and to other controversial or outsider groups like U.S. communists. And so he felt a deep conviction about that. He wrote a manifesto of sorts called Freedom is Everybody's Business, laying out the connections between how important it is to defend people who are outsiders, because that's what civil liberties is really tested. So he was one of the defense lawyers in that trial, and all of them had a contesting relationship with the Judge Medina, and at the end they were all sentenced for contempt of court, and he went off to prison in Kentucky after it had been appealed all the way up to the Supreme Court, and they lost.
But while he was understandably afraid to go to prison, he was treated very kindly by his fellow inmates because they saw him doing the right thing.
That happens a couple of times in that period. Yes, he was sentenced to a segregated prison in Kentucky, and he was considered sort of a heroic figure among the other black inmates. And similarly, another witness at the hearings, Crockett defended my father in 1952. Another person he defended was Coleman Young, the future mayor of Detroit, who was called before the committee as a witness, was not a communist, but as a labor leader associated with communists. And what happened with Young is that he turned the hearings on end because they gave him an opening and he took it and went on the offensive from then on. So Chairman Wood from Georgia and the committee counsel, Frank S. Taverner from the Shenandoah Valley of Virginia, who came out of the Harry Byrd machine, the segregation now, segregation forever machine of Virginia, spoke with Southern accents, and whether it was conscious or subconscious, they said nigra in a way that sounded like something worse. And Coleman Young said, that's not the way you pronounce it. It's negro. And it happened two or three times during the hearings. And then he was on the offensive from then on. They were sort of trying to rationalize their vocabulary. And at one point, one of the members of HUAC was sort of challenging Young's patriotism. And he said, I was an officer in the Air Corps in World War II. What kind of patriotic country is it that won't allow an officer to go to the officer club because he's the wrong color skin? So when Young was done testifying, he later told the great oral historian Studs Terkel that he felt like Joe Louis coming home from a fight, that wherever he went in Detroit, in Black Bottom or Paradise Valley, going into a barber shop or walking down the streets, people would gather around and pat him on the back and praise him for finally standing up to those Southern racists.
And could you describe the method in which they conducted the hearings that did not allow people to make statements and badgered and cadged?
Well, the witnesses had no rights. They were not allowed discovery. They were not allowed to make statements. They weren't allowed to put on any defense of any sort. And that was very much a factor in the emotional effects that this book research had on me. The transcript of those hearings were public record. So I'd seen those for years. You know, my father being called before the committee as a witness and what he said and what the questions were. And at one point in the transcript, you see my father saying, I'd like to read a statement about what I think it means to be an American. And Chairman Wood says, you can't do that. You know, you could only do that if you sought absolution for your sins and confessed and named names. And my father invoked the Fifth Amendment, his right as an American citizen not to testify against himself, so he didn't. And so he wasn't allowed to read that statement. And that statement was buried in the files of the House Un-American Activities Committee for 63 years. No one had ever seen it or read it until I went to the National Archives in Washington, got the boxes for the House Un-American Activities Committee hearings in Detroit, found a file that said Elliot Marinus, opened that file, and there was the statement.
Now, that sounds very much like how they used to do the witch trials in which confession was the only way out, essentially.
Absolutely. And Arthur Miller is a connection between the witch trials and these trials, and my father. Arthur Miller, the great playwright who wrote The Crucible about those Salem witch trials, went to the same high school as my father, Abraham Lincoln High School in Brooklyn and Coney Island, then went to the University of Michigan and wrote for the Michigan Daily, as did my father a couple of years later. Arthur Miller had befriended my, what would turn out to be my uncle, my mother's brother, who was also at the Michigan Daily then. As my father in his statement and Arthur Miller in his play, both wrote about the comparisons between what this committee was trying to do to invoke confessions and what had happened at the witch trials.
Now, your father and so many other young Jewish people went to college in the Midwest is because the Ivies were anti-Semitic and had quotas at the time?
Yeah, there were all kinds of quotas, overt and covert, in America then. And, you know, that started with who my father's teachers were at Abraham Lincoln High School. They were largely Jewish scholars who had master's degrees or PhDs who could not teach in the colleges, and so they taught at the high school, and including his principal, Gabriel Mason, who was a Spinoza scholar, who walked around Abraham Lincoln High, the halls, carrying a pocket edition of Emerson's Essays in his back pocket. And then many of those students from Brooklyn, from Boston, from other East Coast cities that were smart enough to go to an Ivy League school, but there were quotas there, went to either Michigan or Wisconsin in particular. There was a long tradition of that in those two land-grant colleges in the Midwest.
That also parallels women of the time weren't allowed oftentimes to do advanced degree studies, so many women ended up as school teachers.
That's right.
And we had just these generations of overqualified teachers that gave us really smart students.
No, it's true. That's one of the, you know, the pluses and minuses of that whole era is that it also led to great teachers.
While this type of event that your father went through could really affect a marriage, your mother was just as vocal supporter of left-wing politics as he was, so there was not any conflict when it came to that.
No, and thank you for asking about my mother, because she's an important part of the book. She was probably more ideological than my dad. She's obviously thought on her own, but her older brother, Bob, who's another major figure in the book, Bob Cummins, was a member of the Young Communist League at the University of Michigan before she was, and went off to fight in the Spanish Civil War, a key moment in sort of my family's history. So she ran for a student office at Michigan with the Young Communist League. And I only speculate, because I don't have an answer to it, that when my father came back from World War II, you read his letters, and they're very patriotic, and he likes Eisenhower, loves Eisenhower, and writes about how he's searching for tranquility and peace and comfort when he comes home, the way so many veterans did right after the war. And my mother sort of chews him out and says, there's a lot of work we have to do in this country. You know. So the speculation is, what would have happened, where would he have gone politically after the war if my mother hadn't been, you know, so.
But you said he ended up voting for Eisenhower.
He did in 1952. Absolutely, he did. Yes. But my mother, you know, one of her nicknames was Mary the Red. Now, anybody who knew my mother later in life, I mean, from the time I was 8, so she would have been 36, 37, would be shocked by that. I mean, she had very strong beliefs, but she was the most gentle, generous, intelligent, open, somewhat shy, slightly depressed sometimes, but beloved woman that you could imagine. So one headline of the book called my parents like leftist extremists. And you know, they were, I mean, I don't sugarcoat anything. They were members of the Communist Party at one point. My mother's the least extreme person you can imagine.
I mean, she was a big advocate for home ownership.
She was, and that was really important to our family's salvation, is that wherever we moved, she would try to buy a house to make the three kids feel some measure of stability, and really was instrumental in keeping our family together. You know, my father was fired from his job because of those hearings, blacklisted for 5 years. We bounced around from his parents' house in Brooklyn, my mother's parents' house in Ann Arbor, Michigan, to Cleveland briefly, where he worked for the Plain Dealer before the FBI came to town and told the publisher that he'd hired a former communist, and then back to Detroit, a couple of moves in Detroit, to Iowa. Through all that period, she was really instrumental in keeping our family together.
But when you all went back to New York, your father got to go against another tyrant and writing about Trujillo.
Yes,
from the Dominican
Republic. He worked for a paper that was about to fold called The Compass, you know, one of the many New York City dailies. Trujillo was the dictator of the Dominican Republic and had a lot of operatives in New York City. And there was a newspaper man in New York who was Dominican, who was writing critical articles about Trujillo and his henchmen, and this guy was murdered. And my father covered that case for the period before the Compass folded. And at one point was in an elevator, and as he would tell the story, I don't, you know, that's all I can go on, a well-dressed Dominican woman got on and basically threatened him. And said, you know, he has to worry about his future.
Now, you mentioned your mother's brother, your uncle Bob Cummins.
Yes.
And I think one of the most horrific phrases in American political lexicon is prematurely anti-fascist.
Yes. So my uncle was one of three University of Michigan students. When he graduated from the University of Michigan in June of 1937, he and two of his friends from school, Ralph Nefus and Elman Service, went to New York, got on a boat across the Atlantic to France, took a train across France to the border with Spain, climbed over the Pyrenees Mountains into Spain to fight for the International Brigade against Franco and Hitler and Mussolini. And two of the three survived. My uncle survived, and Elman Service, who went on to become a great anthropologist, did. Ralph Nefus, the third one, was captured by Franco's troops, held in a cathedral in the town of Alcaniz, and executed. When my wife and I did a tour of Spain to trace my uncle's route, going to that cathedral, you know, 7-plus decades later, up the winding hills of this town, and it was dark and dank inside, and there were votive candles flickering, and it just felt like a dungeon of death, all those decades later.
Well, you think of the Spanish Inquisition that had happened there as well.
Yeah, exactly. The violence of Spain and the beauty of Spain all mixed up together. My uncle in Elman's service survived, went back to Ann Arbor. There was a grand banquet held in their honor. 600 people attended, one of whom was Bob Cummins's little sister, Mary Cummins, and another was the editorial editor of the Michigan Daily covering the event for the school paper, Elliot Marinus, and that's where my parents met. But Bob, after that, and Elman's service, and, you know, there were probably 3,000 or 4,000 Americans who went over to fight against Franco, and they were all deemed premature anti-fascists by the American government and harassed from then on.
While Congressman Woods was fairly villainous in this portrayal, you have Congressman Potter of Michigan, who had served nobly in the war and had lost his legs and more of himself. And he is not a good person during the hearings, but he does reflect later in life that maybe he didn't do the right thing.
Yeah, Charles Potter was, as you said, it came from Michigan, northern Michigan, fought heroically in World War II, lost both legs in falling on a landmine in the Colmar Pocket, fought in the Battle of the Hürtgen Forest, in the Battle of the Bulge, and came back, and like many young veterans, Main Street Republicans, was elected on a patriotic ticket and made his name as a staunch anti-communist and was put on the House Un-American Activities Committee, was one of those congressmen at the hearing where my father was called, and was using that hearing basically as a stepping stone to get elected to the U.S. Senate, which he was elected to later that year. And then he was put on the subcommittee in the Senate with Joseph McCarthy and pretty quickly saw the machinations and manipulations and recklessness of McCarthy, sort of helped Eisenhower and the military undo McCarthy during the famous Army-McCarthy hearings in 1954, and then 10 years later, basically, wrote a book called Days of Shame, regretting everything that had happened during that period and that he had been part of and allowed to happen in terms of the hysteria of that period. Even defending, which really struck me powerfully, he in the book there's a very strong defense of the Fifth Amendment, which the committee, of course, used as a cudgel. You know, anybody who took the Fifth was unpatriotic, un-American, and guilty. But it is in the Bill of Rights. It's there for a reason. And so he makes that argument finally in this book, Days of Shame. I started this book before Donald Trump was running for office, before he was president. But there are some parallels. There are many parallels between that era and this. And one of them is, who's going to write a book called Days of Shame 10 years from now?
Well, in looking that the Soviet Union and now Russia is kind of involved in both of these eras, what is the difference in the way they approached the Red Scare as opposed to this alleged involvement in the – well, no, it's the involvement of the Russians in trying to sway the 2016
Everything's
election.
Upside down, completely upside down. It's mind-boggling to try to sort it all out. I mean, here you have Trump and his enablers – attacking the FBI and the CIA, the FBI, which was at the center of the investigations of alleged communists and communists during the McCarthy era. You have the president of the United States cozying up to a former head of the KGB, Vladimir Putin. So you can't really make any direct parallels because everything's so tossed up. You know, it's Alice in Wonderland. It's a distorted mirror in so many ways.
Now, you do note that back in that time period, some Soviet-era documents have since come to light that show there were agents inside the government, as I'm sure have been in all governments in history. You always have spies of some sort or another going on. What way do you think would have been more appropriate for the American government to handle rooting out those spies as opposed to the way they went about it in the late 40s and 50s?
There's a distinction between someone who's a private citizen and someone who's working for the government. That's not to say that the way they handled McCarthy went after people in the government, but he did it in a completely irresponsible way. He would deny people their civil liberties. I mean, I'm not saying that there shouldn't have been certain investigations of some people because of their involvement in the Soviet Union. Absolutely. But there are rational, common sense ways to do that, and there are reckless, demagogic ways to do that. And that's what they were doing in that whole period. And so it disrupted and destroyed thousands of lives, ranging from people who were innocent, who were not, I mean, innocent is the wrong word, who were not connected to the Communist Party, but had associations with it, maybe, to people like my father, who had been involved in the Communist Party, but had not done anything wrong. He was an American taxpayer. He'd fought in World War II. He never committed any crimes. He had no connections to the Soviet Union.
He loved baseball.
Baseball becomes one of the sub-themes of the book, because during the 50s, the American Legion and many patriotic groups tried to use baseball as a weapon against the Soviet Union and communism, saying that, you know, no communist could play baseball. Well,
Cubans were
Castro
pushed
that. Yeah, Cubans would have. But beyond that, I mean, I love baseball. My father loved baseball. But baseball's not ideological. You know, politics doesn't matter to baseball. The city you come from matters. Loyalty matters. Numbers matter. The beauty of the game matters. Nicknames matter. But politics doesn't matter.
So who do you follow in baseball?
Well, I'm from Wisconsin, so I'm a Brewers fan.
So that the Nats haven't captured your attention?
Oh, no. I hate all Washington teams. I should say I hate the Redskins, or the Washington football team. I don't hate the Nationals, but they're not my team.
If they had a different owner, would you like them any better?
The
Redskins.
No. It's one of those things where I enjoy their suffering.
Schadenfreude.
Yes, exactly.
So is there another book that you're working on right now?
Yeah, there is. I started researching it a few months ago. It will be a full-scale biography of Jim Thorpe, the American Indian who was the greatest athlete of the 20th century. And I'm, you know, when I write a quote-unquote sports book, I'm looking for both a dramatic arc of a life and some larger sociological significance. And definitely it's there with Thorpe. It's a way to write about the American Indian experience in the late 19th and through the mid-20th century.
So how do you start to put him in context so people of our day can understand how truly great he was during his time?
I don't think I'll have any trouble with that. I mean, how many athletes can you name who were Olympic gold medalists, All-American college football players, founders of the NFL, and Major League Baseball players, all in one? That's a lot, right? And I think that the American Indian experience is one that still resonates. And, you know, he was there during a period when the government motto essentially was kill the Indian, save the man, which means we're not going to annihilate you anymore, but you can't be an Indian. And that was, you know, why the Indian schools were set up. He went to Carlisle Indian School. He went to Haskell Indian School before that in Kansas, then Carlisle in Pennsylvania. They never got the Indian out of Jim Thorpe. He was a sack and fox. And the mythology, which I don't know is true or not yet, but in a sense it doesn't matter, is that he was the great-great-grandson of Black Hawk. He was definitely from Black Hawk's clan and definitely had a sense that he was carrying Black Hawk within him.
Well, thank you so much for coming by today. It has been a pleasure, David.
Thank you, Stephen.
David Marinus is the author of A Good American Family, The Red Scare and My Father, which is published by Simon & Schuster. I'm Stephen Usry, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WIPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.